This week, after four turbulent years, the economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa is improving. This year's growth is expected to rise to 3.8%.
This recovery is good, but as we stress in the note, I mean, nowhere near the robust levels of growth we need to see in the region to address all of our development challenges.
What does this mean for the people on the continent? How can they be uplifted, and how can the economy evolve to include more people into the rising middle class? Abebe Amro Selassie, the International Monetary Fund's Africa Department Director, gives us the big picture. Franny Lutier, CEO of Southbridge Investments, breaks it down for us. Straight Talk Africa starts right now. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm your host, Vincent McCorry, and we're coming to you from the Voice of America's headquarters in Washington. Now, every year, the International Monetary Fund issues a report on sub-Saharan Africa that gives us the big picture on how the economy is doing, and it suggests paths that can be followed for improvement. This year, the IMF reports a lukewarm economic recovery with a 4% growth in 2025. Yet, the region continues to face a funding squeeze even as inflation fell by 4% in February this year. What is leading to the financial pinch for sub-Saharan Africa, which includes eight oil-exporting countries? VOA Africa reporter Ignatius Anno posed this question to Abebe Amro Selassie, director of the African Department at the International Monetary Fund.
The tighter monetary policy conditions that many advanced countries have adopted the last couple of years. Post-pandemic, there was a big surge in inflation as countries had injected quite a bit of fiscal stimulus, quite a bit of monetary stimulus to get economies going. Supply chains were broken, and that led to a big inflationary push. And to combat that, there has been a big tightening of monetary conditions. And our countries being having a lot less access, even under normal conditions, to capital markets internationally, and domestic markets still remaining weak, have faced this funding squeeze. Now, on top of this are, of course, vulnerabilities that countries had because, you know, debt levels were very high. The impact of the shocks that have hit our countries in recent years have also weakened the fundamentals of our economies. There is some recovery taking place in the region. Growth was 3.4% in 2023, expecting to go up to about 3.8% this year, and a bit further to around 4% next year. This recovery is good, but as we stress in the note, I mean, nowhere near the robust levels of growth we need to see in the region to address all of our development challenges.
We're seeing governments across the region look elsewhere for financing options to address the deficit that they face. What's the impact on the economies and amid the high cost of living brought on by global inflation?
It's a really difficult environment right now, so it hasn't been as easy to get funding. So one of the consequences of this has been that countries have had to live a lot more within their means. Institutions like mine, the World Bank, have of course stepped forward. Just to give you a small example, you know, I think since 2020, the IMF has provided financing to the tune of $58 billion just to the sub-Saharan African countries. The World Bank has also been providing quite a bit of support as countries have not had access to markets in recent years. So conditions remain difficult, but I think they're beginning to ease because earlier in the year we saw three countries, Cote d'Ivoire, Benin and Kenya, able to return markets and do some liability management operations. So we're hopeful that this will continue as countries' economic conditions improve.
Now, the regional outlook notes Niger and Senegal among the region's fastest growing economies due to the oil and gas that is supposed to come on stream. Niamey, as we know, is still under a military rule following a July 2023 coup. And the U.S., for instance, has agreed to a request to pull out its troops. Senegal now has its youngest president after months of a political deadlock over the organization of elections. Are you concerned that the projected growth of 10.4% and 8.3% for these West African states could be jeopardized?
Senegal has once again shown that it is a boisterous, robust democracy. There was a peaceful transition of power to a new leader, and you know we are the new leadership has come up with you know some sound ideas about how to move the economy forward. We met with the Minister of Finance recently during our spring meetings. Had very good discussions. They are taking a bit of time to look at what kind of policies they want to put in place, what they need to put in place, and they're working on that, and that's really fantastic that they take their time, look at how they can you know, improve economic prospects there. In Niger, of course, it's going through a very difficult political transition. They also face the huge security challenges with terrorist attacks, internal conflicts that have been ongoing for a while in neighboring countries and now, unfortunately, spilling over there. You know, we are also looking to see how we can support the government in Niger, and we're hopeful that we can reach agreement on you know, we have a program that we're supporting under the Resilience and Sustainability Trust to help them address their climatic shocks. So we're hopeful that we can move forward in supporting them also in the coming weeks.
Let's focus our attention on world events that have had negative impacts on the region's economies. First, we talked about a pandemic, climate events which have led to drought and near famine in the Horn of Africa, for example. The war in Ukraine, which serves as a food basket for some African countries like Egypt. The IMF is advocating fiscal resilience to withstand such shocks. How is the fund positioning itself to assist low-income economies to strengthen fiscal buffers? And in what capacity can the international community offer support?
That's a great question. I think, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, we underestimate kind of what brutal cocktail of shocks have really hit countries in the region. Eh? There was the pandemic itself, of course, and that's been followed by, you know, other shocks which really have been as big in terms of their economic effects on the region. The pandemic, thankfully, saved us from the health effects, although the economic consequences were big, but the subsequent shocks have only served to exacerbate conditions in the region. As you said, higher fuel prices for the countries that are fuel importers, food prices across the region, so major cost of living crisis. What we've done as a fund in this context has been to step forward like never before. As I mentioned earlier, you know, providing financing to the tune of $58 billion, much of it through our zero interest rate facility is really, you know, a big contribution that we've made to help countries support their populations, to, you know, make sure that they can, you know, support their economies. So that's the first thing that we've done. We, of course, continue to remain engaged in policy advice, even in those countries that do not borrow from us, you know, extensively. And as and when new shocks have been emerging, we also have been trying to lean forward to support countries. So just to give you an example, there's a wrenching drought taking place in southern Africa right now, impacting Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, even some countries further south. And we are doing, you know, our utmost to make sure that we can provide support, for example, to Malawi and Zambia to help them deal with this shock. But the fundamental solution to many of the challenges that we see is putting in place reforms that are going to help make our economies more resilient. And of course, the exact type of policies depends from country to country. But the, you know, really, I think what we are going to have to adopt policies that will improve our fiscal resilience, our, you know, resilience to external shocks. And these include measures like further domestic revenue mobilization. Our countries have done a lot of good things in terms of investing in all the right areas, in health, in education, and infrastructure over the last 20 years. But what we've not done enough is capture the rate of return on this investment through our tax system. So that's one of the things we have to do. Second, we also have to look at how the resources the governments collect are being spent. Are they being spent in those areas which will generate the highest rates of return for our economies?
When you talk about reforms, one of the things that come up at the local level is that these reforms lead to governments saying that they have to widen the tax net, get more money from the people who are already been burdened with high cost of living, How do you ensure that such reforms do not go to added on burden to the consumer?
Okay, so I think that's a great question. And, you know, I don't, by no means do I mean to paint a picture where these reforms, these trade-offs that have to be made, are easy. They're not. They really are very difficult. But they're also what needed to move our economies further. So if you need to spend more, if you cannot borrow more because that sustainability constraints, then the only thing you have left is more tax revenue mobilization to, you know, make this thing work and make economic conditions improve. As I said before, in many countries, what you've seen is that economic activity has continued to expand, but tax collections have not kept pace with the expansion of economic activities. Our countries have not done enough of a job in terms of taxing new sectors of the economy as well. So we do see scope in many countries, to expand the tax net, to capture more and more people that are not currently being captured in the tax net. So to the point that you raised earlier about burdening the same people again, I think there is a way to make taxes a lot more equitable, a lot more, broader, rather than deepening and taxing the same people further.
But when the tax net is widened and the people still do not feel that the basic things that are required for everyday living is lacking, then, you know, there's discontent. How do you respond to the people who say, why widen the tax net when it can still be seen in the lives of the economies?
We've done the right thing in expanding electricity access in many cases. Again, it's not universal. But the companies that have expanded electricity access are still, you know, not collecting even, you know, enough to just sustain themselves, much less repay the investments that they've made.
Mr. Bebe Selassie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been good to be here.
Well, thank you, Ignatius, for this in-depth interview. It's time for a short break. When we come back, we will discuss the impact of this big-picture economic outlook on the life of ordinary citizens on the continent. Stay with us.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Obtaining your college degree is a great achievement. However, your next step of finding a job can be daunting. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will explore how new graduates can get ready for the workforce and discuss the need for soft skills to help boost their chances of employment. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganya. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in...
Welcome back. We are talking about the economic challenges facing sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF's Abebe Emeritus talked about the overall financial outlook and pointed out that the growth is tepid and that a funding squeeze still persists. For insight into what all this means for the average person in Africa, we're joined by Franny Lotier partner and CEO of Southbridge Investment, a Kigali, Rwanda-based international firm. Franny joins us today from Paris. Hello, and welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Vincent. Good to be with you once again.
It's a pleasure. Now, Imro Selassie talked about the economy, the African economy growing somewhat this 2024 by about 4%. For the person who's going to the market, who's just buying vegetables or putting gas in their vehicles, what is this supposed to mean to them when they compare 2 or 3 years ago?
Yes, first of all, I really enjoyed Abebe Selassie's interview. The three quick things that come out immediately from a slow-growing economy for the average person. First, for Africa just to reduce poverty, it needs to be growing at 10% for several decades. And so when you're growing at 4%, it means you're not able to generate the kind of economic growth that will give people jobs, expanding the job opportunities, and without jobs, incomes are suppressed. The second immediate effect is in a slow-growing economy, there isn't sufficient funds in the public purse to spend on priorities, for example, education and health, building the infrastructure that is needed. And then finally, a slow-growing economy would not be able to sustain the important other kinds of support that society needs, which are taken for granted, for example, in more advanced economies, like social services, healthcare being the primary one. So the average person would immediately feel that there are fewer jobs to go around, that it's much more difficult to get the kind of services that are basic, health, education, infrastructure, including electricity, which is fundamental. And finally, they would not have anywhere to go should something go wrong and they need healthcare. So those are the very three basic things that an average person would feel in a slow-growing economy.
Yeah. Now, of course, as you say, the desire or the ideal should be growing at about 10% or more. A continent that in most countries, they're strapped with high interest debts. They're trying to service those debts. They're dealing with natural disasters. The incomes are very low and decreasing by day because of certain other internal, dynamics. How realistic is even even that dream of not only 10%, but even of growing at 7%?
Yes, that's a great question, Vincent. And I think the key is really in bringing more people into the job market and to support small and informal businesses. Because by doing that, you expand the size of the cake, and therefore more people can be served from the same cake. So if you take the example of the private sector in Africa, 80% of what we call the private sector in Africa is made up of small and medium enterprises. When you have the current conditions with very high interest rates, those types of companies cannot get access to affordable credit, and therefore they're not even able to meet their working capital needs. That means they cannot grow, and if they can't grow, the economy cannot grow. Second, the companies that are seeking to improve the contribution to different value chains. If you take the example of agriculture, the fact that most African economies are stuck in a primary agricultural producing environment. If a small and medium enterprise wants to go to the next level, let's say, and process mangoes into mango juice or slice them, dry them, and export them, let's say, to the United States, that kind of activity requires debt to build the types of factories, bottling plants, packaging plants, and so on. You may have to pay for imports, and at the moment, with a very low value of African currencies against the US dollar and other foreign currencies, those imports become very expensive. And thirdly, many banks would rather put their money into treasuries and bonds rather than lend to a small and medium enterprise that may have trouble paying back. And therefore, they may not actually have any access to credit. So that really is one of the main constraints.
Yeah, that paints almost a very pathetic, almost impossible situation here, because we're talking about over 80% of people in the informal sector. Most of these are actually small businesses at different levels. And even the whole question of expanding the tax base, how do you even collect taxes from people whose businesses you cannot clearly define? And in terms of their even affordability, they're already squeezed because they cannot access credit, just because there's no infrastructure for that. So with this kind of a population, with this kind of a demographic on the continent, between small-scale farming and small-scale businesses on the roadsides of African cities, how can the economies be organized in order for this kind of small-scale farm to become a pillar of economic, or rather small-scale business to become a pillar of economic growth?
I think there are many examples of success in doing that. If you take East Africa, countries like Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania have started first by issuing very easily digital IDs. So as an individual, you have a national ID, that means you are known. And once you are known, most of these small companies are one or two person companies. You can then go to a bank and get a micro loan, or with what East Africa is doing very successfully now, offering digital platforms that do not require any collateral or paperwork. You just need your national ID to prove that you are not, you know, engaging in money laundering or any such activities. You register your business very easily, and from that, you are able to get access to finance. And that also means you are now visible to the government, and the government can start to tax you. But one has to be careful not to tax the informal, formalized informal sector too high, because that would kill the businesses, mm-hmm. which is where the support from government also comes in, to provide cheaper loans to the small companies, to offer subsidies in some sectors. For example, if you want to grow the food value chains, as was done during COVID in Cote d'Ivoire, where you can give grants to the wallets directly in the e-wallets of the digitalized services for the companies, and they can then use those funds to expand their businesses or use it for working capital. And then thirdly, by making it cheaper to collect taxes, which the digital technologies help do, you can then broaden the base of tax collection without necessarily having to spend more to do it. Yeah. And I think these three actions, we have a number of countries that are doing quite well now in using those approaches.
Now, how about the level of knowledge on taxation? In most of these countries, it looks like for the longest time, certain groups of people are not being taxed or not being taxed adequately. But then countries just come to the realization that they need to collect tax. We've seen this in countries like Kenya. And then just one day, they introduce tax in rent. They introduce tax for landowners who never pay tax before, taxes for people doing small businesses, and of course, also tax for constructing, for example, affordable housing. This is creating almost a havoc in some of these countries. How can countries approach this in the best way so that they can benefit from the tax from citizens, but also not make citizens feel like they're really being pushed to the corner?
Indeed, that is a really critical issue. First, one has to educate the policymakers. And here you have the IMF Institute, which does that. They offer courses on tax collection and revenue management. But you also have the Macroeconomic and Finance Management Institute, which is funded by the World Bank and others, that trains finance ministers, central bank governors, and so on. And then you have the African Capacity Building Foundation, which does the same. So that's an important area for the policymakers. Secondly, the government has to show, and really do it transparently, that it is using tax-collected revenues efficiently, so that issues like corruption are handled, efficiency in producing services is demonstrated, and then citizens can see that the taxes that they pay go towards services and products that they can benefit from. And then finally, it's educating the citizens themselves. to show them why it's important to pay taxes, what are the benefits then of paying taxes, and linking then the political agendas with the policy agendas. And here you can say there are a number of countries that are doing that well, but it goes hand in hand with having a well-functioning democratic representative government. And so you cannot disentangle, I think, sometimes the governance side from the tax efficiency side.
And of course, there's the whole question of resources that many African countries have. And some have said, why don't you first maximize on the resource base where you find countries that are awash with mineral wealth, the same countries that are very poor. We can talk oil, we can talk gold and diamond. So how about that? Should that be the first place to go before you even think taxation for the small scale farmers and business people?
I think if you tax the mineral and hydrocarbon wealth, it can cause some very serious global effects, which then end up hurting Africa even more, making cost of capital even more expensive. So the key issue is, yes, those sectors should be taxed at the appropriate level, but they shouldn't be the only source by which governments look for taxes. Instead, governments should focus on diversifying their economies so that they have many more sources of wealth that can be taxed. Focus on growing the economies through the examples that I gave by bringing in the informal sector into the main economy, supporting small businesses to grow, and bringing the kind of policies that generate jobs, because that will allow the government to have many more sources of taxation. And diversification has an advantage because it can lower the cost of products. If you take the example of many cities in Africa, 80% of the average food basket for a family in a major African city is processed food that's imported. These are things that Africa can do and manufacture on its own. It has large land resources it can use. And I think focusing on those kind of activities could lower the import bill, give more revenues that could be taxed, and broaden the economic base.
Now, some have said that, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, they give these prescriptions, you know, look like great ideas. But way back, we remember the SAPs that failed in some countries, the structural adjustment programs. Do these suggestions always work just because they came from the IMF or the World Bank? For different countries, because every country is at a different economic level of development and also has different dynamics within itself.
Yes, I think the structural adjustment programs were not very well conceived for all types of economies, and they were applied in a cookie-cutter manner that actually ended up hurting some of the economies. Lessons learned from that are, first of all, one should listen to local policymakers because they know better the solutions to use for the economies they're facing. And here there's an organization called the African Economic Research Consortium that has been training economists and supporting research of good economic policy ideas. And those economists now are working in government, in central banks, and they are better able to now address when policy directions come, say, from the World Bank and the IMF, to fine-tune them and make them more relevant for the local economies. Secondly, I think it was important to have learned quickly and adjusted from the structural adjustment programs, which I think was a bit slow in doing. And the World Bank has learned lessons from that, as has the IMF, and they put in place the poverty reduction policies and other factors that have helped to address the lessons learned. But then finally, I think the opportunity to provide safety nets and focus on health and education, these were very critical and they were not properly done during the period of structural adjustment. And I think the lesson learned, and that Africa applied very well, for example, during COVID, the fact that Africa did not come up totally.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, very well put there. We'll have to leave it right here. Thank you, Franny Lotier. He's a partner and CEO of Southbridge Investment Firm. Thanks to our affiliate stations for broadcasting Straight Talk Africa across the continent. I'll see you next time.